are listening to Free Radio Santa Cruz. My name is John Malkin, and the name of this program is The Great Leap Forward. You can hear this show usually at 7 p.m. on Wednesday nights, right here on Free Radio Santa Cruz. My very special guest this evening is Ray McGovern. He is a former analyst with the CIA. He worked for that agency for 27 years, and for the past 25 years has been an activist working to stop militarism and consumerism in the United States. Ray McGovern will be the featured speaker at a screening of the documentary film Drone on Saturday, April 30th, 2016, at 7 o'clock at the Vets Memorial Building as part of the Real Work Labor Film Festival. McGovern will be giving a talk titled America's Drone Program: The Dark Realities of Modern Warfare. The film screening and Ray McGovern's talk are being co-sponsored by Veterans for Peace Chapter 11, the VFW Bill Motto Post Number 5888, the Romero Institute, the ACLU of Santa Cruz, Women's International League for Peace and Freedom, Food Not Bombs, Code Pink Santa Cruz, and People United for Peace of Santa Cruz County. For more information about this film screening and event with Ray McGovern, check out reelwork.org, R-E-E-L, work.org. Here now is Ray McGovern. Well, there's a number of things I'd like to ask you about. One of the things I want to start with is drones. You are coming to Santa Cruz to speak before the screening of this film, Drone. It's a relatively new way of destroying things and fighting battles and assassinating people, these unmanned drones. And the film Drone I watched, and it's quite interesting and dynamic. And a lot of people are interviewed in it. One of them is Brandon Bryant, who is an ex-drone pilot for the U.S. Air Force. And he killed quite a few people, 1,600 people or so. He says that it's sort of like a bad science fiction story, and we're watching it happen. There's a colonel who's interviewed in the movie who says there's 87 countries that have drones now, and this colonel says it's only a matter of time before we have a drone over New York City, and it isn't one of ours. What are your main concerns and thoughts about these unmanned drones that are being flown over Afghanistan, Iraq, Yemen, Pakistan?
Well, John, let me provide a little bit of background that many of your listeners might not know. And that is, these drones, they were developed for a specific purpose, a legitimate purpose, actually, for intelligence gathering. The background is this. We have all manner of very sophisticated satellite and other collection mechanisms. But the satellites, they used to, perhaps they still do, go over a certain point on Earth just twice a day. Not only that, but people could predict exactly when they would come over a given spot on the Earth, and camouflage and concealment there could easily be arranged. So the intelligence community had a felt need for what we called a dwell capability, a platform that would dwell over a certain suspected terrorist training camp or whatever, and be able to be there like 24 hours a day and watch what was going on, and maybe as long as a week, and a video stream imagery right back to a station. And we could find out what was going on. Now, those aircraft were developed, Lockheed aircraft and all those other high-tech arms manufacturers were delighted to do this. They were relatively cheap. In the beginning, they were only $1 million a piece, only. And so that worked. And then when the general there in the Pentagon said, hey, you know, I bet we could put missiles on those things and kill a lot of people. And, you know, nothing sells like this capability. And so they asked the arms manufacturer, you think you could do that? And they said, no problem. Just cost X billion or billion dollars, and sure we can. So they had the Hellfire missiles already developed. Raytheon, I think, does those. They were actually anti-tank missiles at the beginning. But they could easily be retrofitted and fitted on these drones. And so here you have Predators. Here you have all other kinds of Reaper drones. In other words, they even name them what they are. They predate, if you will. They patrol and they look at people. And not only do they send messages back or imagery back as to what's going on in a certain area, but if somebody in their wisdom at Hancock Air Force Base in Syracuse or Creech out there in Nevada looks at the screen and the imagery that's coming back and says, you know, there are three of them there. They look like adult males. Therefore, they meet the description of a ipso facto terrorist in this particular part of Afghanistan or Pakistan or wherever. So, presses the button. Relay station in Rammstein, Germany, gives the okay. And 3 seconds later, if you can believe it, 3 seconds later, those three people, whoever they happen to have been, are no longer with us on this earth. They're blown to smithereens by a Hellfire missile. So that's the background as to how these things came into vogue. Now, when this capability became known to the people who were scratching their heads about, oh, this is awful, and we get all these people into Guantanamo, they don't know anything because they were all sold to us for bounty there in Pakistan. We can't accuse them of anything. We can't let them go because we tortured them. They were back in terrible, terrible thing. So, what are we going to do? Well, hey, when I was in the Army, John, we used to talk about capture or kill. Now it's just kill. Okay, it makes it a lot easier. You don't have to mess with whether the person is a POW or whether the president can exempt categories of prisoners like the Taliban and Al-Qaeda from the Geneva Article 3 protections. You just kill them. And if they happen not to be terrorists, well, you can rehabilitate them by identifying their bodies and saying, well, these people were not terrorists ex post facto, like a post-mortem. Now, isn't that neat? In other words, the U.S. Army and the CIA will shoot up these three people that I talked about before. And then if by some stratagem there's a parachutist that comes down and looks and says, oh, whoops, this one. Now, two of those other, they were seen with a suspected terrorist in Beirut 7 years ago. They're terrorists. But this guy, actually, he's a missionary. Actually, he's an American. So we only can count two today. That's how bad it is, John. That's how bad it is.
Mm. In the film Drone, there's an interview with a man who helped to develop drones, and he eventually sold his idea to the U.S. military. Andy Van Floto, he was saying that in around 99, he developed these flying crafts, and he was hoping to sell the idea to tuna fishermen who were not so interested in it, but the U.S. government was quite interested. So he's offering some sort of rationale for drone warfare. He says young men like to smash things, and he says if we are to have war and warriors, we need to equip them the best we can. What's your sense of that kind of rationale for these new machines and this new technology?
Well, John, let's go to the general first. if there were a better way to enhance and elongate the lines before Al-Qaeda and other terrorist recruitment centers, a better way than drones shooting up people, I don't know what it is. Whatever you might think of it with respect to keeping U.S. Air Force people safe behind their consoles, drone warfare comes across to militants, so-called, or terrorists, as the utmost cowardly act. And so, if you're interested in inciting, if you're interested in cultivating the field for new terrorists, an endless supply of terrorists, then drone warfare, you couldn't come up with a better idea than that. Now, I say that not facetiously. You know, I've come around to the idea that it's not macabre, that it's not outlandish to point out that there are people profiteering from making drones, from supplying the technicians, the training, all this. There are billions with a B, like in boy, billions of dollars to be made on this technology. So someone is profiteering from, I don't say profiting, I say profiteering from this. And as long as the drones don't endanger any of our young men or women, as long as they can be targeted at people who don't look like us, and I say that divisively, racism is a main factor in our blithe attitude toward killing people who don't look like us. Go back to Vietnam for that. Oops. Go back to Iraq, towel heads and camel jockeys. That's what our troops are trained to call these folks. These are human beings. So just getting back to the general, if you want a low-intensity war, as the Pentagon says, where arms arms can be manufactured and sold, arms manufacturers and what Pope Francis called the blood-stained arms traders, can make piles of cash, and I'm talking U.S. cash, and that they can take a portion of that, put it in the back pockets of our senators and our representatives, and get them reelected. Then those senators and representatives will vote to authorize, to appropriate still more funds, with still more drones and other weaponry. And, I mean, this is a great country or what? I mean, the cyclical sort of thing, it's what Ike warned about. Unfortunately, they didn't do much about it. But the warning should have been enough. The military-industrial congressional complex. And I use that word because Ike used it, okay? He used it in his first draft. It was struck because people are that's going a little too far, Ike. You know, let's just say military-industrial. So this is the wider picture. Who profiteers, who profits from this kind of stuff? Now, as far as the human cost, not only are people terrorized, but our own soldiers, our own Air Force people, are brutalized. I mean, you need to train somebody to be inhuman to, after having killed somebody, say, bug splat, as if a bug splattered on your windshield window. Now, to their credit, a lot of these Air Force pilots, like the one you just mentioned, have had conscience problems. This. And they've given up their careers, and when they're given 1,000 or 1,600 confirmed kills and given an award for that, they are conscience stricken enough to say, wow, this is a strange country. It gives me a medal for killing 1,600 people, some of which I know to have been civilians. Nobody's perfect in targeting. And that's the thing, targeting. Now, when you look at drones, I know a little bit about this. People say, well, now, Ray, these Hellfire missiles, are they as accurate as everybody says? And my answer is, yes, they are. They're supremely accurate. But the problem is, how about the targeting information? Is that accurate? And I have to say, no, it's not. What do they use for targeting information? Well, the head of NSA has admitted that we kill people because of cell phones. We figure out who has a cell phone, might be a terrorist. We see that the cell phone in operation, whoop, whomp, that person is bug splat. Well, it could be, you know, is it somebody they know? Well, no, but we know the cell phone. So, in this case, they're killing a whole lot of cell phones. Whether the people attached to those cell phones are wives, children, or grandmothers of these so-called suspected terrorists or militants, well, we don't have to worry about that. We're at war, after all. The usual rules don't apply. We're going to kill these guys because that's what we're trained to do. So that's one way that the targeting works. The other way is, let's say you're Joe Schultz in Afghanistan, right? And you live next to Harry. And Harry you hate, like, with a passion, okay? And Harry's just been a real drain on your resources. You want to get rid of Harry. So you go to the local authorities and you get a little device. And you tell them that you're living next door to a terrorist. And they give you this device. And you put it on the side of Harry's house there. Guess what? You go away for a week, and when you come back, well, Harry's not there. His house is not there. Pretty neat, huh? Well, he could have been a terrorist, but he was primarily a personal enemy of Joe Schultz, and so you don't have to worry about him anymore. That's how corrupt it is. It's the only benefit that the U.S. Army and U.S. Air Force sees in any of this. No people sitting at consoles in Creech Air Force Base, Nevada, or in Hancock Air Force Base, Syracuse, New York. Nobody gets killed. Nobody gets harmed except their moral character, except their conscience. And many, many more drone operators are refusing to do what they've been ordered to do. And they're having trouble, frankly, replenishing the lines of the folks to be trained. And chaplains, this is interesting, chaplains at these Air Force bases are having a lot of new business from people who come with the kinds of battle wounds that you don't see on the outside, but that are just as grave, PTSD that you wouldn't believe, okay? Sit around, you know, killing people all day with drones, saying, bug splat, hey, I'm up to 1,000 now, maybe I'll get an award. Then you go home, and you have dinner with your family, right? And your kids and your wife. Say, hey, Daddy, what'd you do today? Well, you know, that's got to be a little awkward. He's not going to say, I bug splatted 50 people, you know? He's going to say, well, I can't tell you. That's got to wear on a person after a while, wear on a family, and it's not what we Americans should be really doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. It's a whole nother level of warfare that's disturbing. I wonder what you think, Ray, are the best strategies for stopping U.S. warfare, which has been in my lifetime constant. And as you mentioned, mostly on poor people with brown and black skin around the world. Some people, some activists regularly are trying different strategies. I really appreciate Catholic worker folks like Kathy Kelly and Brian Terrell, who were arrested again a month ago at a military base in Wisconsin where shadow drones are flown from. What's your thought about activists who try to intervene directly and stop drone pilots from continuing, or try to make contact with pilots and talk with them, and other strategies that you think might be effective?
Well, John, I have the utmost admiration for Kathy Kelly, who's a friend of mine. She and I were on the U.S. boat to Gaza back, 2011, I guess it was. Also, Alice Walker was on that boat. We never did get to Gaza because our president, even though we were a U.S. registered boat, he couldn't convince his Israeli counterpart, Bibi Netanyahu, not to shoot us up as he had done to a couple of Turkish boats the year before. very apologetic Greek Coast Guard people who said, please turn around, please, we're under orders, so you can't leave, you please turn around. And here's, you know, Greece, seafaring nation for, what, four millennia? They're embarrassed to behold, and they say, please, please, we don't want any trouble. And then the Ninja Turtle guys come with the machine guns. Finally, after an hour standoff, our captain turns around, and the boat was impounded, and is no more. Now, why do I mention that? Well, Alice Walker was there, and this was activism. This was activism in favor of exposing the incredible injustice in Gaza, which is one of the reasons why people resort to terrorism. I mean, not people in Gaza. I mean people all over that part of the world who identify our policy with the policy of Israel. So what is Alice Walker? What does she say about activism? Well, very simply, she says, I look at activism as the rent I pay for living on this planet. Well, that's a nice way to say it, isn't it? With all this stuff going on, it doesn't suffice to make speeches and write articles and write books and poetry like Alice does. You have to put your body into it, which, to a great credit, Alice did. Now, the reason that we didn't get to Gaza was because our president wouldn't stand up to Netanyahu when he asked him not to shoot us up. Netanyahu smiled. So what our president did was go to the Greeks, who are much more malleable, leaned all over them and said, look, you want your next IMF loan? You let any of those boats, there are several, leave Greek shores, and that's finished. Expect no new loans from us. That's how bad it is. Anyhow, Alice put it succinctly for me. One of my other heroes, of course, is Cesar Chavez, and I can't get out of my mind what he always said. He said, look, thanks a lot for the op-eds and the speeches. They're terrific. But you know what? Without action, nothing's going to happen. Now you say, you all say, oh, but there aren't enough of us. There aren't enough of us. Well, there are enough of us, says Cesar Chavez. But without action, nothing's going to happen. So I'm out on bail. Of Catholic workers, and I shut down Hancock Air Force Base where they pushed the buttons for the drones. This was back in February, and I, you know, our day in court comes, I think, in another month or two, but I'm out on bail, so I'm very happy to put my skin in the game. I think more Americans need to realize that it's getting pretty late, and Dr. King warned. He said there is such a thing as being too late. When we watch history, when we look at what the Germans were unwilling to do in the 30s, what other people are unwilling to do because they're just too darn comfortable, well, you have to say, it's getting to be too late. If you care about the kind of country that your children and your grandchildren are going to inherit, well, we've screwed it up pretty bad for them. It's time now to put our bodies into the works, as Mario Salvio once said.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you being willing to put your body into the works, and I know that there have been times when your body has been bruised and hurt when you've put it in the line. In 2011, you stood with your back to Hillary Clinton as she gave a speech, and you have written about Hillary Clinton that she's partly responsible for the deaths of thousands of Iraqis, Afghans, Americans, Iranians, and potentially Iranians, you were saying. Tell me about these times when you have gone to speeches by Hillary Clinton, and also Donald Rumsfeld was quite interesting, the exchange you had with him. What were these experiences like for you?
Well, let's start with Rumsfeld, because that happened first. This was back, wow, it's 10 years ago now, May 4th, I think it was, 2006. He was going to make a big speech down in Atlanta. And by coincidence, I was getting an award from the ACLU in Atlanta, an award that Coretta Scott King had won the previous year. So I was just really humbled and really happy to be down there. And somebody says, hey, Rumsfeld speaking. Now, we couldn't get a ticket because it was a very, very elite. Okay, elite? Well, in Atlanta, that means male, well-heeled, white, aged, defense-friendly think tank. Okay, they had a website, but there's no mention that Donald Rumsfeld was coming. So I said, you know, if somebody gave me a ticket, I'd love to go there. Maybe ask him a question. Well, the women from the World Can't Wait came forward and said, we get your ticket, right, but it costs you $70. That was the hard part, John. You know, $70 to hear. Well, I decided to make the investment. Got there an hour ahead of time. And I saw there were two microphones toward the front. And so I sat myself as close as I could to one of the microphones, the place right next to it, already occupied by the first designated questioner, okay? So I'm sitting there. And he's saying all these lies that I knew to be lies. And some of them had to do with the speech I was preparing for that evening. And so I'm thinking, wow, you know, I better be up at the microphone, ask him if he stops and so forth. And then a woman has a big banner and she waves it and says, Rumsfeld, war criminal. Well, she is made short shrift of. I mean, she's picked up and thrown out. Okay. She was about my age, not a young woman. And so Rumsfeld says, you know, he says, I just feel so disappointed when people, you know, people have banners that, you know, say Bush war criminal. And I'm saying to myself, wait a second. Wait a second. The cameras didn't show it, but it said Rumsfeld. So, you know, I'm Irish, right, John? I'm seething. And then Rumsfeld says, you know, that kind of attitude, I just have to, it deprives government of the trust that government needs to govern appropriately. And here I am, you know. So I'm, anyhow, he finishes his speech, and I'm thinking, well, you know, I could just ask him some questions, but I'm reluctant, you know. I'm saying, oh, look at these people, they, you know, going about, there's going to be a no good end, as the Chinese used to say, for McGovern. And then I thought, this is significant. I thought, you know, if this was Cindy Sheehan, if this was Anne Wright or Kathy Kelly, they wouldn't be having this conversation with themselves. They'd be up at the microphone asking questions. McGovern, what kind of a wuss are you? Lesson here. Hang around with good companions. You'll get more courage than you ever had before. So I'm up at the microphone. I ask them two questions, basically. One is, why did you lie about weapons of mass destruction? And then why did you lie about ties between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda? He denied that he said either. Luckily, it was early enough in the afternoon that people could do fact check. And Keith Olbermann did a real job on Rumsfeld. Just by quoting me and him during a 9-minute segment, you can get it on, it's still getting hits on YouTube, which I'm delighted to see. Long story short, that was a unexpected pleasure. And, you know, as I was going out of the auditorium, which is really kind of a fire trap, I noticed only then that there were about eight, what do you call them, I know that Russians call them the special elite black-clad stormtroopers were there to protect Rumsfeld. They weren't there when I arrived an hour at a time, and thank God they weren't, because I don't know if I would have had the courage even when thinking of what Cindy and Anne and Kathy would have done. Anyhow, this is a little side note here, which I think speaks volumes. I'm halfway out of the auditorium, and I get this call on my cell phone. Hello, Mr. McGovern, you're causing quite a stir down here. Huh? I said, who's this? This is Anderson Cooper. I'd like to have you on my show tonight, but I have to ask you a question first. rock at the time, John, and, you know, that's an ordinary question. So I started by saying, well, no, you know, I had briefed the Secretaries of Defense for you. And then I thought, wait a second, this Anderson Cooper, this is the heir to the Vanderbilt fortune. This is the pretty face on CNN. He's not going to be out on the streets of Atlanta with his hat in his hand. So I decided, I said, Anderson, let me be candid with you. I had done my homework. I knew that he'd either have to admit that he lied before or lie again to these key questions. And to tell the truth, Anderson, you know, it was a real high. As a matter of fact, you might think about it. If you do your homework and ask real questions, you'll experience that, and you'll get a real high. And I said, well, thank you very much. I'll have my people get in touch with your people. I said, yes, I don't have any people. No, sorry, I don't have any people. Just call me back to my cell phone. So what did I tell you? Now, Anderson Cooper is not the worst of them. But he's asking me, wasn't I afraid? And that speaks volumes, because even the likes of Anderson Cooper are afraid to ask real questions. And that, I'll take advantage of this opportunity to say what I always say. I am sitting in my backyard here, having been 50 years in this house in Arlington, Virginia, having started with the Army and then the CIA. So I've seen a lot of change in this town. But there's one change that dwarfs all the other changes in significance. And that change is that we no longer have, in any real sense, a free media. That is big. And that is precisely why I'm happy to talk to people like you, John. Just talk to anybody who called me and asked me for my views. Because we are in the business of trying to spread some truth around. But it's a high hurdle. It's a real challenge to get out into the media. Thankfully, there is a fifth estate, which I think the internet should be called, and as more and more people, particularly young people, forsake the likes of the New York Times and the Washington Post and really try to figure out what's going on, the internet will come into fruition, and that gives me great hope. As a matter of fact, people listening to this might be better informed about things than they would be had they read what's called the mainstream press.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, we didn't talk about Hillary Clinton. You want me to quit to that?
Sure.
Okay, well, this was 5 years ago. It was around Valentine's Day. And so 2011, and I'm sitting at my computer, and somebody sends me this message that Hillary Clinton's going to be making a big speech at a sort of small auditorium in George Washington University. And they're selling tickets, so I tried to get a ticket, but I couldn't get one. So I went to a friend of mine who was a professor there. I said, could you get me a ticket? And he had to struggle mightily, but he did finally get me. It was the last ticket to be gotten there. So we're talking, let's see, the 15th of February, 2011. I arrived an hour and a half early because I wanted to sit up front. And I had no idea what I might be moved to do, but I knew what she stood for. And I went through security that you wouldn't believe. They talk about going to Dulles Airport. Well, this time they took not only my computer, but they made sure that Microsoft Word was Microsoft Word, that PowerPoint was they fiddled with my computer for about 10 minutes. And then I got in and I sat down. Then I had to go to the men's room. Whoa. I went back through security again. Anyhow, I got back to my seat in time. I think it was 12 o'clock she was supposed to be speaking, but she didn't come. And then about 20 after 12, big stir, and in she comes. Everyone stands and applauds for a half hour, probably about 2 minutes. Then the president of the university gets up, and he flowerily gives her what I'd call fulsome praise in the original meaning of fulsome. And it goes on for 3-4 more minutes. They're all standing up, and I'm standing, and I say, well, this is for the birds, McGovern. This woman is responsible for untold misery, attic. Those are the words we used. And Scott Ritter, the head UN inspector, one of her constituents from New York State, couldn't get in to see her because she didn't want to hear that all those weapons of mass destruction had been destroyed in 1991. She didn't want to hear about it. This is the woman who's responsible for all of it. It was even before Libya, a couple of months before she decided, well, Libya would be next. So I decided that I had to dissociate myself. I couldn't let her leave this gathering thinking that everybody was just wrapped in warmth for her. Took off my outer shirt. I happened that morning, the only clean undershirt I had was my Veterans for Peace shirt. So that was a piece of luck, I think. So I turned my back on her and didn't say a word, just fixed my gaze at the back of the auditorium. Well, it went well for about 2 minutes, and then all of a sudden I see this bulky guy in a suit, you know, regular civilian suit, wandering down the aisle toward me. He looked like kind of like a Washington Redskins reject, you know, big guy. And so he comes and he's about, oh, maybe 10 feet in front of me. And I say, oh, this is going to have a no good end. And I'm taken down from behind. And I don't know who it is took me down from behind because I can't see him. They grab me in this kind of chokehold where they put their fist in this part of your neck here. And they lifted me over the three women between me and the aisle and took me outside where they administered some brutal stuff to me, okay? Two pairs of steel handcuffs. I'm bleeding profusely from my wrist and so forth. Suffice it to say, after an hour, I was taken to D.C. jail, spent 3 hours there, then went to the emergency room, found out nothing was broken, and that's the end of that particular story. But, you know, Hillary Clinton, her speech was about the necessity to provide protection for dissent in Iran. You know, it was something out of Franz Kafka, you know. Here, she watches this done to me. I couldn't have been more than 10 yards from her. I was right in the middle, you know. And she didn't. My friend said, she didn't miss a word. Well, if you watch the video, and it's on Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, she doesn't miss a syllable. She just ignores the whole thing. And so when she came out against Trump for saying, this is no way to handle dissenters in your rallies, my God, I couldn't believe it. Because not only did she supervise all that, or at least not take any cognizance of it, but I was put on the State Department BOLO list. Now, for those of you people not within the Beltway, I have to exchange with a BOLO thing. And that BOLO is be on the lookout for. What they did was they went into every database that the organs of public security in this country have and found out that, you know, I was okay. I was clean. And so they said, he's a dissenter. His political views could get him some attention, and therefore we're going to put him on the be-on-the-lookout list. If you see Mr. McGovern, stop him, detain him, and immediately call State Department Security. Whoa! So, you know, what about the First Amendment? What about the Fourth Amendment? 14th? I mean, hello? So they establish in writing that I'm no threat to anything, that I'm, you know, I may have some audience because of where I used to work. They mentioned I worked for the CIA. And so stop him, detain him, and call State Department Security immediately. Wow. So luckily there's a pro bono law firm that jumped in and said, you know, at least we could get that BOLO lifted. And indeed, with some embarrassment, the State Department said, yeah, they really shouldn't have done that. They had it in, I think, for about 7 months. And we thought it was completely lifted not only from State Department records, but from, you know, all the other, I say organs of state security, because that's the translation of the Russian that we used to use for the KGB, the MVD, and all the organs of state security in the Soviet Union. And not that there's any likeness at all, but anyhow, we thought it was all removed, but then in New York, a year and a half ago, I'm up there teaching, actually, at my alma mater, teaching just one course, and I heard that General Petraeus was going to be speaking. And this was right after all those crackerjack, all those crack troops that he had trained in Iraq for so many billions of dollars. When somebody from ISIS took a couple of AK-47 shots in their direction, they all ran away, like 250,000 of them. Well, I exaggerate. They didn't all run away, John. The officers took helicopters out of the area, okay? So I said, this is great. You know, maybe I can go to his lecture. If they have Q&As, maybe I could even ask him, General Petraeus, how do you explain those crack troops that you're so proud of having trained, that they ran away, didn't they? Could you comment on that? Now, that was what I was going to ask. Now, the Bolo was alleged to have been lifted, but somehow or other, even though I got a ticket to a cutout, a woman that I didn't even know, they knew I was coming. And so no sooner am I in the door than the head of their security says, first name, Ray, you're not welcome here. We're not going to let you in. I couldn't believe it. I said, what? I have a ticket here. Look at that ticket. In the back of the ticket, it says we have the authorization to revoke that ticket at will. Now, I had printed the ticket out on my computer. I said, no, there's nothing on the back of my ticket. So I proceeded to the turnstiles, and then five more. In this case, it was New York Giants. New York Giants rejects grabbed me. The cops were right there. They gave me to the NYPD. And I was treated to not only a little brutality at their hands, but also a whole night in what they call the tombs. And I'll end it here, but I suggest that every American should spend one night in the tombs. This is the prison underneath the criminal court in Lower Manhattan. Dostoevsky, my favorite novelist, used to say that the mark of a civilization, the level of a civilization, can be determined by visiting its prisons. If you've not been in the tombs, you don't know much about the U.S. prisons. Talk about being treated as a subhuman person. I was there just between 2 o'clock in the morning, and when I finally got arraigned, 11 o'clock the same morning. It was an experience that just one night, I suggest to everyone. You need to get through it to see how people who are judged to be marginal, who are judged to be other, or they don't look like us, how they're treated. So I treasure those hours, although it was pretty tough going through it at the time. Nothing came of that because the lawyers that asked, why were you screaming in pain? And I said, well, I had fractured my left shoulder 3 days before, and they were trying to put my hands around my back. That's why I was screaming in pain. And they said, did you have a note? I said, pardon? Did you have a note from your doctor that you had fractured you? I said, come on, wait. Well, the NYPD could do whatever they want. That's their standard practice, to put your arms behind your back. And then, sure, they needed to do two sets of handcuffs for you because they couldn't get the shoulder to go back there. But they were in their rights unless you have a note from your doctor. Did you have a note from your doctor? No, I'm sorry, I didn't. So there you go. My experience with the organs of state security.
Hmm. Wow. Yeah, interesting stories. I mean, it's not a surprise that quite often activists who are focused on stopping war or stopping drones or stopping nuclear testing, who end up going to jail or prison, they end up working on stopping prisons or prison reform. Kathy Kelly, has ended up doing that a bit since she was in Pekin Prison. Hey, Ray, I want to hear, I'm really curious to hear a little bit about the CIA. And I'll throw out a few ideas and whatever you'd like to respond to. You have been a social change activist for over 25 years now. For 27 years before that, you worked for the Central Intelligence Agency. And I'm really curious how that evolution came to be that you decided to leave. You mentioned earlier how some drone pilots in the United States end up having conscience problems and leave that vocation. And I wonder if that's what happened with you. And maybe more importantly, I mean, how did you stay working there for so long? What were your values and beliefs around what you were doing? And I'm curious, you know, there's other ex-CIA folks who came out in the 70s and 80s, Philip Agee being probably the most famous and writing a book about CIA activities around the world, John Stockwell also. I don't know if those folks and their writings and speech giving inspired you. So I'm curious about your time at the CIA and what you thought about what you were doing when you worked there. I mean, one thing, just to mention one last part of this, it's pretty clear that torture is not a humane thing to be doing to any living thing, even if you have the idea that it's going to save lives. So there's some, I would say, a faux debate about torture in this country. And in the meantime, the United States is advocating and using torture in a lot of places. And you have written about how that's a big problem. And the CIA has always engaged in torture around the world and trained death squads and trained other people in torture. So I'm just curious about your evolution in your thinking and your life, going from working for the CIA for 27 years and then leaving that.
Sure, John, those are all fair questions. And as you will imagine, I've been asked those questions before. My answers are not real sexy. In other words, I didn't fall off my horse on the way to Damascus, and other things that people expect me to say, I don't say because they're not true. Now, what people have to realize is that there are two CIAs. There is the one that President Truman intended, an analysis group, to be able to tell him without fear or favor what's going on in the world. He didn't want it to be shaped by State Department policy, nor by Pentagon influence. He knew that the Pentagon would tell him that the Russians were 10 feet high. He knew they weren't 10 feet high. There's no one around to tell him, well, exactly how high they were. So he wanted an analysis unit reporting directly to him, not to the Pentagon, not to the State Department, that would have career protection for telling the truth. Now, down here in Washington, if you tell somebody that you worked for a place for 27 years that had no political agenda, their eyes glaze over and they go, right, Ray, right, tell me another one, you know. But you know what, John? I worked for most of that time for a place that had no political agenda, where I had career protection for telling the truth, even if a four-star general was saying that we can win in Vietnam. We told the president, forget about it, we can't win here. Now, the answer to that, of course, is that the president is not obligated to heed the advice of intelligence analysts. His political priorities, President LBJ, Lyndon Johnson, decided that he didn't want to be the first U.S. president to lose a war. He disregarded the advice, not only of us, but of academics who knew something about Vietnam and knew something about the Civil War there. And so he became, well, what we say, the first U.S. president to lose a war. Similarly, this whole stuff in the Middle East lately has been really divorced from any sensible analysis that has been served up to the president. So let me not get ahead of myself here. I was able to, my specialty, my graduate degree is in Russian studies. I used to teach Russian. It was a natural progression in the 60s to go to the CIA. I had a very active account for analysis. It was the Sino-Soviet dispute, the dispute between Russia and China, the international communist movement, the reverberations there, and Far East. I had the purview over Soviet policy toward Vietnam. Very, very exciting stuff. And for the most part, I was able to tell it like it is. There were exceptions. There always are. But we had our ethos was to tell the director and the president what the way we looked at it. Now, if you go back to when CIA was created, we're talking 1947, the National Security Act, 1947. They created not only the CIA, John, but the Air Force, you know, the Defense Department, the National Security Council. I mean, there was big legislation. The CIA legislation had all been prepared to set up exactly what I just described, an analysis unit. Now, there was one thing that would be a little peculiar about this. Since it was widely recognized that you couldn't get the whole story from the open press, that, in other words, you needed to be able to recruit and run your own spies to get information not otherwise available, there would be one part of this analysis group that would be secret, that would be engaged in clandestine intelligence gathering. That was all par for the course, sort of a typical intelligence setup for any major country. So it had to be secret. Well, what happened? Well, 47, 48, 49, the overthrowers of government, we call them regime changers now, the very courageous people, very imaginative people of the Office of Strategic Services, the OSS, who worked miracles in the European and Asian theaters, Pacific theaters, well, they came home to Washington. And they were received with great applause, well-deserved applause. But then they said, well, now, thanks a lot. You want us to hang around here, or should we go back to our corporations, our law firms, back to academia? And now, 1947, 48, Russians had already overrun Eastern Europe. The KGB was flitting all around the world, overthrowing governments, okay? And so the leaders of our country and their wisdom said, hey, if the Russians are doing it, we have to have the capability to do it. Sure, stay around. Don't go back to your law firms, your university. Don't go back to corporations. We need you here. And so we developed this covert action capability, and the question became, where are we going to put these guys? I mean, like, we can't have a Department of Covert Action. We couldn't even, they weren't even smart enough in those days to call it regime change, right? So, oh, I know, says some idiot. I know what we can do. We're forming the CIA. And it's got to be secret because they're collecting information from spies. So we'll put the overthrowers of government, right? Yeah, that's what we do. We'll put the covert action people right in with the analysts, and there'll be one big happy family. We'll have to change the legislation a little bit. Oh, yeah, we'll stick in one sentence. And the sentence says, and it persists to this day, John, the director of Central Intelligence, now the director of National Intelligence, shall perform such are the functions and duties related to intelligence as the president shall from time to time direct, period, end quote. Such are the functions and duties. Now, I'm quick to add that this is an authorized people to do illegal things, break laws, break UN conventions or the law against torture. That doesn't authorize that, but there it is, right there in the legislation. And so if you get an unscrupulous president like George W. Bush and a toady director of Central Intelligence like George Tenet, well, George Tenet would just cite that little sentence, and, well, the president told me to do it. So torturing people forever. Well, the reality is, as far as I know, that when 9/11 happened, and on that evening, and we have this from Richard Clark, who was there, right? Somebody said, well, hey, this is good, a chance to go against Iraq. And Rumsfeld, of all people, said, well, you know, Iraq didn't have anything to do with this, so it would be a little international law problem there. And the president, according to Clark, said, I don't care what the international lawyers say, we're going to kick some ass, period, end quote. Now, that's word for word, all right? Now, imagine what he did the next day when he called George Tenet, head of the CIA, and he said, oh, we're going to be capturing all kinds of people, Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. So you got people and giving them the business? I mean, Dick Cheney says we got to go to the dark side here. What, you got people who can do that? Now, the reason I mention all this is because if George Tenet, for once, answered honestly, he would have had to say, no, Mr. President, we don't have anybody like that. We've been liaising with liaison services in Central America and elsewhere who do the torture, but, there's a training manual that has been developed, but we don't have any torturers. As a matter of fact, we don't even have any interrogators. The closest we come are people who do the lie detector tests and brief people as they leave the agency and so forth. So, but we can get them. Oh, I know we can get them. There's some people left over from Vietnam, and they have contact. And yeah, a lot of contractors. We can bring them. That's how the torture started. People were brought in from the inside, and then Donald Rumsfeld, for his own purview there, got the torture permitted at DOD, and none of the generals stood up to him. So that's how the torture began. It's all part of the record. The Senate Armed Services Committee has an extensive report without dissent, and so does the Senate Intelligence Committee. So just to kind of finish up this long explanation, I was able to tell the president what I thought about the Sino-Soviet split, later about larger things when I worked on the president's daily brief under Presidents Nixon, Ford, and later Reagan. I worked one-on-one with Ronald Reagan's top advisors, and I'm talking Secretary of State Schultz, Secretary of Defense Weinberger, Chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, and so forth. I briefed them one-on-one, and I told them the truth. That was heady duty. Now, often, I didn't know the whole truth, but they never asked me for the whole truth because they were getting the whole truth from the covert operators. So you have this bifurcation up till today. The president doesn't learn about how many people are being subverted or what regime is being overthrown by the PDP briefer. PDP briefer is kept in the dark, as I was kept in the dark, about covert action. So you have this hybrid. You have this very, very, well, I call it a structural fault in both senses of the word from the very beginning. So long story short, toward the end of my career, after I finished briefing President Reagan's most senior advisor, we didn't see President Reagan liked to sleep in, right? So we gave morning briefing to his chief advisors, and they briefed the president on what we had told him and other things later in 11 o'clock, 11:30, and decent time for somebody from California. So toward the end of my career, I did notice that a fellow who used to work for me, his name is Bobby Gates, that he was responsible for adulterating, or not too strong, prostituting intelligence. Long story short, he was in my branch, my first managerial job when I was, 30 years old. He was a bright guy, but so was Bill Goodman. So many other people in my branch were really, many of them had PhDs in Russian history. Okay, it was the Soviet foreign policy branch. Gates was a disruptive influence in the branch because, bright as he was, he kept flitting around at levels two bureaucratic levels higher than I, ingratiating himself with whomever he would impress. not surprised. Actually, I put in his fitness report that he was this disruptive influence because of what he's doing. He didn't like it very much. But I was not surprised 10 years later when Bill Casey came in. And Bill Casey could see a Soviet under every rock in Nicaragua, right? And Bobby Gates learned that, and he turned over some rocks, figuratively speaking, and said, "Mr. Casey, you missed this. There are two Soviets under that rock, and over here there are three." Well, this is to oversimplify, but not by much. Those who could see those Soviets under those rocks got promoted under Bobby Gates, whom Bill Casey made chief of analysis. And so you had a bureaucratic situation where no longer were people promoted on the basis of their intellectual or their analytic humor, but rather they were all kind of the careerists. Now, why do I mention that? I mention that because that was 1981, 1982, when Gates took over. It takes a generation to corrupt an institution. Fast forward to 2002. George Tenet, by that time he was served by lieutenants who had become managers under Casey and Gates, okay? Why is that relevant? Well, they pointedly avoided writing an estimate on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq because they knew there weren't any. And that was not welcome news in the White House. What happened? Well, in September 2002, Bob Graham, the head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, said, "Hey, Bush and Cheney want us to vote on a war in Iraq. I don't see any really need for it. And I'm the head of the Intelligence Committee. You better do an estimate to tell us what you think about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq." Well, Tenet went down to the White House, and he said, "Graham is insisting that we do a national intelligence estimate, so I guess we need to do one." And the White House told him, "Yeah, you have to do one, George. Just make sure that it says the same thing that Vice President Cheney just said on the 26th of August before the Veterans for Foreign Wars. Just take that and make sure that you say the same things. And by the way, it's got to be done in 2 weeks, okay? You got that?" Tenet salutes, goes down. I wasn't there anymore, but I know how this works, and I've spent countless hours in the director's conference room. Goes back to the conference room, and who's there? Assembled there are all these very, very malleable managers, I call them, willing to do whatever is required of them for their careers. So Tenet says, "It jigs up, and we got to do an estimate on Iraq." And oh, the terms of reference, well, we're going to get those from the Vice President's office, and we got to do it in 2 weeks. Now, John, I want to tell you that in the day, as they say, in my day, if a head of the CIA came into that room and said those things, we would have said, "Sure, that's a good one. Sure, you're not serious." And if he said he was serious, we would be out that door. There might be a sycophant here or there who would stay, but he would know that he had an insurrection on his hands. Well, as I said before, it takes a generation, a prostitute, to corrupt an agency. So, 1981, 2002, that's almost a generation. Well, certainly enough. They saluted smartly. They served up, get this, please. Not a mistaken estimate. A fraudulent estimate. It was fraud through and through, and they knew it. And that was used. Why the two-week time frame? Because it needed to be produced on the 1st of October, which it was. Why? Because the midterm elections were coming the next month. They wanted to make sure that people like Hillary Clinton and the others would have to vote for this or otherwise seem weak on the threat, the obvious threat that Dick Cheney had painted from coming from Saddam Hussein. That's a very, very sad chapter in this whole thing. Now, as for me, 1981, I became 50 years old. Now, if you serve enough time in hazardous duty and become 50 with a certain amount of years in service, you can retire on an immediate annuity that's reduced, greatly reduced, they're good to say, but it's reduced. And I figured if I could work down in the inner city where my heart really was and make that up, you know, get some sort of job which would complement my retirement, that maybe this was the time for me to leave. And I became 50 in August of 1989. Besides that, in November or later, it became clear that the Soviet Union was going to collapse, right? So I automatically became an expert on a country that didn't exist anymore. That was a bummer. That was the downside of the downfall of the Soviet Union. And last but not least, Bobby Gates had so corrupted the analysis part of the agency. You know, I mean, the overthrowers of government and the regime changers, they didn't really have to worry too much about the law or telling them the truth. So I could see where people would really have a cognitive dissonance trying to figure out, well, was there part of the agency that did know the truth? Well, I'm here to tell you there was, but it was corrupted by the likes of Bobby Gates and George Tenet and their acolytes. So by the time 1990 came around, I said, well, what more, how many more indicators do you need, McGovern? You can finally go down and work in the inner city, and you can get some kind of retirement immediately, and you don't have to worry about Bobby Gates anymore. And besides, you can go out clapping yourself on the back because the Soviet Union had fallen apart. Now, it wasn't just me, John. But it was sort of a relief that the main enemy had sort of disintegrated, and I had great hopes at that time because George H.W. Bush, who actually was a friend of mine at the time, I had briefed him every other morning for 4 years, he was taking the right attitude by telling Gorbachev that we're not going to take advantage of your situation. We're going to work things out so that we can have peace in Europe between Lisbon and Vladivostok, is what he said. I think he truly meant that. We saw what happened when Bill Clinton came in and NATO was enlarged and everything else, and that's where we are today. But there was great hope. So I said, well, yeah, you go down in the inner city and not worry about what's going on in the world. Little did I think that just, 1990, yeah, just one decade later, I saw my former profession corrupted to the point of falsifying intelligence to justify deceiving our elected representatives out of their constitutional prerogative to declare or otherwise authorize war. That's as bad as it gets. That's precisely what happened. If you look at the dates, the estimate was on the 1st of October. The midterms were in the middle of November. We gave Saddam Hussein impossible terms for UN inspections to resume. And he fooled everybody by saying, okay, come into my bathrooms. Just remember to put the cap on the toothpaste, okay? But you can go any way you want. And that's what was happening for 2 months before George W. Bush said, well, we're going to pull the plug anymore. Anyhow, we got generals here that do shock and awe. We got intelligence people that torture. Man, I'm going to be the first. He said this several times. I'm going to be the first president. First war president of the 21st century. And Dick Cheney's in the background saying, yeah, right, George, we're going to do this. Now, look what's happened in the Middle East. Talk about unintended consequences. I think they really were unintended, but there are a lot of people profiteering on what happened, and those are the people that Pope Francis called the blood-stained arms merchants, the arms manufacturers, the people who have offered Saudi Arabia, for example, $100 billion, B as in boy, $1 billion worth of arms just during the Obama administration. Now, I hasten to add, I don't want to exaggerate here. People say, now, McGovern, don't exaggerate, for God's sake. Only $50 billion have been approved. Well, John, maybe I'll just leave it at this. I don't think that whether only is an adjective or an adverb here, it doesn't matter. It doesn't seem to be quite appropriate. policy? Well, number one, look to where Israel perceives its interests. Whoops. Yep. Look at it. And then maybe you can understand the ins and outs of U.S. policy since Hillary Clinton and Obama took over. And number two, look at the military, industrial, congressional, media, security services complex. And be afraid, not of terrorists so much, be afraid of the incipient fascism that is being introduced under that rubric, military, industrial, congressional, media, security services complex.
Thanks for all of that. And yeah, it seems the underlying people who profit throughout all of this are people who are selling weapons. Do you have time for one last question, Ray?
Sure.
I was thinking I'd like to hear from you about surveillance and Edward Snowden and Julian Assange, but, you know, I'd rather hear from you about some things that you just brought up. Having worked with presidents of the United States, Bush and Reagan and others, you mentioned Reagan liked to sleep in, which is an interesting metaphor for his presidency in a way. I guess what I want to hear from you is about electoral politics. and we're coming up on an election for president, and people are campaigning these days. Some lefty activists have the attitude that in some regard, it doesn't really matter who the actor is that's elected. Ronald Reagan was literally an actor. There's scores of other people who actually hold power and take actions, and the president is sort of an actor or a puppet. I mean, a lot of people had high hopes for Obama, who talked about doing some specific things, mostly which he has not done, like close Guantanamo. And apparently he approves a kill list every day for people to be assassinated by drones, like we were talking about earlier. Hillary Clinton is running for president. We already know about her war activities. Donald Trump obviously would be problematic to be a world leader. Bernie Sanders, I mean, what's your thought on this idea that in a sense it doesn't really matter who's president? Bernie Sanders, I think, you know, if he had the space to do it as president, he would make some very positive changes. Does someone in that spot as president of the United States actually have ability to make positive changes?
The answer to that is yes. And this is not Pollyanna. This is not pie in the sky. I've seen them do it. Now, I too run into this syndrome. You know, a pox on both your houses. Who cares? Chris Hedges, whom I admire greatly, you know. I heard him just 3 weeks ago talk about, it doesn't matter. It doesn't, if it's not going to be Ralph Nader, it doesn't matter. And they're all corrupt, and what we need is a revolution. Okay, well, you know, he also said during that speech, this was at the Saudi summit run by Quote Pink, an incredibly interesting couple of days. He also said that, as Chris Hedges said, that, you know, I'm a Calvinist, okay, so maybe that influenced my thinking. Well, I don't know a lot about Calvin, but if it suggests that everyone has to be really pure or everyone else is really evil, I just don't know, but it seems to me that that's not the real world. More than that, it seems to me that we got George W. Bush because Ralph Nader didn't do what he promised to do, that is, bow out before he threw the election to George W. Bush. think that's what happened. I think we might try to learn some lessons from that, you know? My God. Now, what's going on now? Well, people are saying, oh, well, you know, it doesn't really matter. Or if they're saying, well, you know, Sanders, he sounds pretty good, but he'll never be able to do that. That's Hillary Woodcullor, because he'd never be able to do that. Well, curiously enough, there was an article, a major article, in the Washington Post, of all places, today, which says that everyone in the establishment is running around with their, you know, worrying about the House, that people are so disenchanted, so disaffected, that despite all the gerrymandering, that the Republicans might lose the House. Well, you know, hello? Yes. So what I'm saying here is that if Sanders wins in Wisconsin, and then New York, and then California, he's going to have big, big coattails. And, you know, shouldn't we allow for the possibility that he comes in as president with a House that is not as recalcitrant as the one now, with a Senate that perhaps has a Democratic majority? These things happen. Stranger things have happened. So what I'm advising people is to say, look, make your own decision, but for Pete's sake, be a little bit wary of these people who are so either purist or so despairing with respect to how our electoral system works. I think that despite, it's a bit of a miracle, John, it's been a miracle. I mean, when you look at the coverage that the mainstream media, so-called, has not given to Bernie Sanders, if you look at the New York Times and the Washington Post coverage where they're absolutely rooting for Hillary Clinton, well, the good news is that nobody below 30 years of age reads the New York Times or the Washington Post anymore. That's good news. It used to be good news. There used to be good stuff in there. Not anymore. And so there's a good possibility, it seems to me, that finally even the mainstream media is going to have to wake up and say, whoa, wait a second. This guy is for real, and it looks like he might prevail at the convention. If that happens, and if it goes to the general election, it seems to me, and this again is from an amateur, that Sanders will win hand down, no matter who Republicans put up, and he'll win with such coattails that he'd be able to achieve one hell of a lot that no one expects anyone to be able to achieve right now. So I would caution against being too jaundiced, being too down in the mouth about all the things that have happened. Good things can happen as well, and I just never thought I'd be in a position here, what is it, almost April, and not despairing, thinking that that a woman, and you know, I've been thrown out of the Catholic Church because I'm a radical feminist. Okay, I have nothing against women, but a woman named Hillary Clinton, I do have a lot against. Not that she just let me get beat up in front of her. It's a lot more than that. It's something that people mention all the time. She's never seen a war that she didn't really think was a great idea. Witness what happened to Libya. So I thought that the prospect of having to vote for somebody like Trump against somebody like Hillary Clinton, that, you know, maybe I didn't know what I'd do. But now it looks like there's some hope. But I can't believe a lot of my friends are just unwilling to, you know, maybe they're so burned by the hope and change from 8 years ago that they can't believe that our country is capable of doing the right thing. I think it is. So I expect great things coming out of the next couple of primaries and the convention. And remember where you heard it first.
Mm-hmm. I do, too. And I'm hopeful, too, and curious to see what happens. Ray, I'm really delighted we had time to talk. I really appreciate this time with you, and I look forward to seeing you in Santa Cruz when you come here for the screening of Drone. Thanks for speaking with me.
You're most welcome, John. I'm really looking forward to being with you as well.
You've been listening to an interview with Ray McGovern. Ray will be in Santa Cruz on Saturday, April 30th, 2016. He'll be giving a special presentation at a screening of the documentary film Drone. Again, that is Saturday, April 30th, 7 o'clock, at the Vets Memorial Building, downtown Santa Cruz. For more information, check out realwork.org. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz.